Ryle, as most of you know, is probably best remembered as a writer of tracts, commentaries, and devotional works, and deservedly so. His tracts are still distributed today. His commentaries are still on the Gospels, are still consulted, and his devotional writings like Old Paths, Practical Religion, and Holiness have remained popular with evangelical readers for over a century. You can go buy them in the bookstore right now. But Ryle was also keenly interested in history. In fact, he wrote 25 short biographies of major figures in English church history and published a number of popular historical works about the English Reformation. For Ryle, history wasn't merely interesting, it was instructive. And for Ryle, no period of English history was more instructive than the middle of the 18th century. He writes this, "I venture to think that there is no period of English history which is so thoroughly instructive to a Christian as the middle of the last century. It is the period of which we are feeling the influence at this very day. It is a period with which our grandfathers and great-grandfathers were immediately connected. It is a period, not least, from which we may draw most useful lessons for our own times." Ryle was convinced that the life and ministry of George Whitefield had much to teach his own generation. Ryle diagnosed the condition of the mid-Victorian church in 1854, and his diagnosis was that it was unwell. The religious census of 1851 revealed that absenteeism and Sabbath breaking abounded, especially in London. The church was failing to meet the spiritual needs of many of its parishioners, especially in large urban towns. There was an immense amount of ignorance of the leading doctrines of Christianity. Romanizing clergymen were attempting to unprotestantize the church from within, and evangelical churchmen were in danger of being thrown out. The remedy, according to Ryle, was more men like George Whitefield. In his biographies, he specifically sets out Whitefield as an example as a preacher, his ministerial character, his activism, and he thinks that the church also needs to handle men like him better. So for Ryle, the church needs more of Whitefield's preaching, character, activism, and less ecclesiastical mismanagement. As Steve mentioned a moment ago, Ryle actually wrote a number of biographies of George Whitefield. The first was published in 1852. It was originally a lecture delivered before the Church of England's Young Men's Society. And the purpose of the lecture was to help young men form a just estimate of Whitefield's worth and to hold him up as an example of what the grace of God can do with one zealous Christian who is determined to work for God and has truth on his side. This biographical lecture in 1852 became the basis and the foundation for all later biographies of Whitefield. 2 years later, in 1854, he published a work called The Bishop, The Pastor, and The Preacher, which contained biographical sketches of Hugh Latimer, the bishop, Richard Baxter, the pastor, and George Whitefield, the preacher. And it included an important introductory essay on the present condition of the Church of England entitled What is Wanted? Although the biography is essentially the same as the one in 52, this introductory lecture sheds new light on Ryle's interest in Whitefield and his relevance to Ryle's current situation. The third biography of Whitefield is included in the Christian Leaders of the Last Century. And in your book, in your bag, when you signed up, you got a little bitty excerpt of it right here. The purpose of this work was to bring before the public in a comprehensive form the lives, characters, and works of the leading ministers by whom God was pleased to revive Christianity in England 100 years ago. He considered Whitefield the first and foremost of this crew. He covers much of the same ground in this biography as he did in the previous, but it differs in a few important respects. In Christian Leaders, two chapters are devoted to Whitefield instead of one. Secondly, he adds new material from Whitefield's letters and journals and expands his analysis of Whitefield's character. And thirdly, and somewhat surprisingly, he removes material from previous biographies, including specific discussions of Whitefield's churchmanship, theological opinions, and practical lessons for the present, which makes this biography somewhat less polemical and less practical. And he includes a short excerpt of one of Whitefield's sermons that you heard last night, What Think Ye of Christ, in order to illustrate his preaching style. So let's look at those things or those ways in which Ryle thinks Whitefield is an example to his generation. First and foremost, Whitefield is a preacher. And thus, if his life has anything to teach Ryle's generation, it is how to preach. Ryle devotes more attention to this aspect of Whitefield's life and ministry than any other, which is hardly surprising given the fact that Ryle believed that evangelical clergymen were falling short of their fathers in this respect. He attributes the shortcoming to a variety of causes. Inadequate time for sermon preparation is partly to blame. Inadequate homiletical training is partly to blame as well. But the lion's share of the blame falls on the preachers themselves. Their subjects are too narrow. Their matter is too repetitive. In terms of style, they lack simplicity and boldness. In short, evangelical clergymen have neither the fervor, nor fire, nor thought, nor illustration, nor directness, nor holy boldness, nor grand simplicity of language which characterized the last century. One of the greatest wants of the church of the 19th century is more preachers like George Whitefield. But in what sense is Whitefield exemplary for Ryle? Undoubtedly, Whitefield was a naturally gifted orator, but Ryle rejects the notion that these natural gifts explain his remarkable success. Ryle identifies 7 qualities that made Whitefield an effective preacher. First and foremost, he preached a singularly pure gospel. Secondly, his style was extraordinarily lucid and simple. Thirdly, he was remarkably bold and direct. Fourthly, he preached with tremendous earnestness. Fifthly, he possessed a singular power of description. And sixthly, he preached with immense amount of pathos and feeling. Finally, his action or delivery was nearly perfect. In sum, no English preacher ever possessed such a remarkable combination of excellencies as Whitefield. And the closer preachers approach his example, the closer they come to attaining true eloquence, that strange power of making oneself believed. Many of the characteristics of Whitefield's preaching became characteristics of Ryle's. Like Whitefield, Ryle strove to preach a singularly pure gospel. His preaching, for the most part, centered on the cardinal doctrines of the evangelical gospel: ruin in Adam, redemption by Christ, regeneration by the Holy Spirit. And when he addresses other subjects like eschatology or pressing contemporary matters, he almost always returns to these cardinal doctrines at the end of his sermons. Because of the focus on these essentials of the gospel, Ryle's denominational loyalty is often difficult to detect in his sermons, which made them popular with a broad swath of evangelicals. The same was true of George Whitefield. Like Whitefield, Ryle prized simplicity in preaching. He believed that simplicity was of the utmost importance to every minister who wished to do good to souls. After preaching the truth as it is in Jesus, Ryle said, "The second most important object for a preacher is to be clearly understood." Ryle discovered the value of simplicity in preaching early in his ministry. After failing to gain the attention and keep it of his rural congregations with his florid speech, he crucified his style and developed his own style, which was characterized by simplicity and directness. He would later write a book on the subject called Simplicity in Preaching. And it's worth noting that in this work, he commends all of the elements of simplicity that made Whitefield's sermons singularly lucid and simple. Perhaps reading Whitefield's sermons helped Ryle develop his own simple and direct style, for which he later became well known. But what's more likely is that studying Whitefield's preaching confirmed some of the discoveries he made on his own. Like Whitefield, Ryle's preaching is bold, direct, and often confrontational. He refuses to speak in terms of we. In fact, he hates it, and he regarded the phrase to be too indefinite and confusing. Instead, he spoke in terms of I and you in order to create a face-to-face encounter between the preacher and the hearer. His aim was to speak like one who had a message from God. One example of this you can find in Living or Dead. It's a sermon he preached in 1849, and he's addressing a hearer who is ignorant of his spiritual condition. He says this: "You do not know, yet all around you is uncertainty. You are a frail, poor worm. Your body is fearfully and wonderfully made. Your health is out of order in 1,000 ways. The next time the daisies bloom, it may be over your grave. All before you is dark. You do not know what a day might bring forth, much less a year. Oh, why not bring your soul's business to a point without delay?" It's worth noting that in this short paragraph, Ryle uses the phrase "you" or "your" 9 times. And frequently, that's accompanied with a direct address is coupled with sobering observations that demand a response. It's typical for Ryle. In addition to being a model preacher, Whitefield's character was also exemplary. Ryle doesn't hide Whitefield's faults in his biographies. He erred in judgment. He occasionally mistook his own inclinations for divine leading, and he could be hasty and overcritical with his pen. Yet these faults notwithstanding, Ryle concludes, "Well, indeed, would it be for the churches of our day if God was to give them more ministers like the great evangelist of England 100 years ago." As was the case with preaching, Ryle believed that evangelical clergymen were falling short of their evangelical forefathers in terms of character. ease, popularity, and the absence of persecution proved to be ruinous to some. Political questions and issues sapped the vitality of others, and the desire to appear intellectual or liberal or both paralyzed the ministry of still others. In short, they are not men of one thing, separate from the world, unmistakable men of God, ministers of Christ everywhere, indifferent to man's opinions, regardless of who is offended, if they only preach the truth, always about their Father's business. One of the greatest wants of the Church of England is more ministerial character like George Whitefield. Ryle identified 7 character traits in Whitefield that are worthy of imitation. First, he possessed a deep and unfeigned humility. Secondly, he was a man of burning love to Jesus Christ. Thirdly, he was a man of unwearied diligence. Fourthly, he was a man of eminent self-denial. Fifthly, he was a man of remarkable disinterestedness and singleness of eye. Sixthly, he was a man of singular, happy, and cheerful spirit. And finally, he was a man of extraordinary Catholicity. In Ryle's early clerical addresses, he frequently commends those qualities to others that he praises in Whitefield. For example, in An Example in Word, 1853, he encourages his fellow clergymen to be more charitable and develop the singleness of eye that was so characteristic of Whitefield. In Neglect Not the Gift, in 1853, he warns against the dangers of ministerial indolence and melancholy and exhorts them to be more watchful, humble, and self-denying. In Not Corrupting the Word, 1858, he urges ministers to exalt not themselves but Christ and care nothing of what men think of them so long as Christ is magnified. And in Give Thyself Wholly to Them, 1859, he insists that ministers must be a man of one thing and be entirely devoted to the work of ordination, which in turn will produce happiness, joy, and peace of conscience. In terms of his own character, Ryle resembled Whitefield in at least 2 respects. And the first is Ryle's Christocentrism. For Ryle, Christ is the sun and center of the gospel and all Christian spirituality. And real religion consists of knowing Christ experimentally as our own Savior, our own priest, our own friend, the healer of our conscience, the comfort of our heart, the pardoner of our sins, the foundation of our hope, and the confidence of our souls. The person and work of Christ is a common thread that runs throughout Ryle's remarkably diverse body of work. This is true of his historical and controversial writings, as well as his popular tracts, published sermons, and commentaries on the Gospels. And this is especially true of his hymnals. Though often neglected, Ryle's hymnals provide excellent insight into his spirituality in general and his Christocentrism in particular. For example, in preface to Hymns of the Church on Earth, 1861, Ryle states that he purposefully selected hymns that are full of Jesus Christ, whether living, dying, rising, interceding, sympathizing, or coming again. Of such hymns, Ryle says, the church can never have too many. And the person and work of Christ dominate all other spiritual themes in every hymnal. In fact, Christology typically occurs more than twice as many times as its nearest rival, the Christian life as a difficult pilgrimage. In addition to Christocentrism, Ryle possessed a Catholic spirit. To the surprise of many modern evangelicals, Ryle was a convinced and committed churchman. He believed the 39 Articles are superior to all other doctrinal standards. He was convinced that the Episcopal form of government was more scriptural than any other. He preferred the prayer book with all its blemishes to extemporary prayers. He considered the church's system of endowments to be better than the voluntary system. He was convinced that the territorial system provided better pastoral oversight than the congregational system. And he believed the church's system of admitting members was calculated to do more good than the practice of most nonconformist bodies. And yet he cooperated with dissenters and encouraged others to do so. He joined with dissenters in supporting the British Foreign and Bible Societies and London City Mission. He spoke with their ministers on various platforms. He entertained their leading members in his home. He even preached for successive weeks in a Presbyterian pulpit. Furthermore, he blamed the Church of England for the church's neglect or mismanagement for creating the vast majority of dissent in the first place. In 1854, he argued that the most scriptural policy for churchmen was to work with dissenters whenever possible. But Ryle's attitude towards dissenters soured over time. Their advocacy of disestablishment and secular education made it practically impossible to work with them in many instances. For example, in 1873, he advised the Church Association not to partner with dissenters in opposing ritualism, despite their common Bible, Protestantism, and evangelical principles. He argues, "I have not the bit of high churchmanship in my feeling about nonconformists, But before I go in for a union with them, I want to know where they are, what they are about in the present day in the matter of education and disestablishment. They appear to put themselves in such a thoroughly different position from that which their forefathers occupied in the days of Doddridge and Wesley, and have such strange opinions about the place of the Bible in elementary schools that I, for one, am not in favor of making advances to them. When I see the language they use about disestablishment, and when I find them moving heaven and earth in order to obtain a dissolution of the union of church and state, I feel very cold indeed about the proposition that we ought to hold our hands out to them and invite their aid. Let them go in on their own way. We can go on well enough without them. We are strong enough to go on with our work ourselves. Ryle's Catholicity had practical limits. In addition to his preaching and character, Whitfield was the paragon of evangelical activism. According to Ryle, this was one of the great practical lessons of his life. To the young men of the society in 1852, he says this: "Here also is your example, young men, if you desire to do good to souls. Whether you become ministers or missionaries or teachers, never forget you must fight with Whitfield's weapons if you wish to have any portion of Whitfield's success." Whitfield was an exemplary evangelical activist in at least three respects. First and foremost was his zeal for conversion. Ryle said that he seemed to live only for two objects, the glory of God and the salvation of souls. This was the great object of his preaching, and as a result of his labor, he became the means of converting thousands. Simply put, the direct good he did for the souls of men was incalculable. But Ryle notes that Whitfield's evangelistic fervor did an incalculable amount of indirect good as well. His preaching indirectly revived the old truths that produced the Protestant Reformation and made him a blessing to thousands more who never heard him. He writes, "His constant assertion of the doctrines taught by the Reformers, his repeated references to the articles and homilies, and the divinity of the best English theologians obliged many to think and roused them to examine their own principles. This not only gave the evangelical body within the Church of England a mighty impulse, it, according to Ryle, ultimately saved English Christianity from destruction." Ryle, like Whitfield, longed to see sinners converted under his own ministry, but he feared that many of his evangelical clergymen were forgetting this great object of the gospel. He says this: "Too many of us are apt to content ourselves with the mere external effects of the ordinances of the church. We are too ready to believe that all must be going on well if the church is filled, the Lord's table well attended, and the school full of children. Our system flourishes, our party increases, our adherents are numerous, yet we lack something. We forget that all this is only outside work. It is a matter for thankfulness so far as it goes, but it's not everything. It is all nothing, we ought to remember, if souls are not born again and names not written in the Lamb's Book of Life." Ryle's own evangelistic zeal is apparent in his sermons and addresses. In his first published sermon, he tells his congregation that "my heart's desire is conversion for the unconverted." In one of his final addresses as the Bishop of Liverpool, he urges his clergy to engage the souls of their people with more kindly, friendly, and evangelistic aggression. Almost every sermon Ryle preached contained an unmistakable invitation for sinners to come to Christ for salvation. Secondly, Whitfield was a model of ministerial diligence and laboriousness. Ryle believes that it would be difficult to name any other minister in the annals of church history who worked so hard for Christ and so thoroughly spent himself in his service. His ministerial labor, as we all know, became the stuff of legend. Ryle highlights his incessant preaching, his prodigious travels, his regular work in London. And in his biographies, he talks a great deal about all of the different things that he did, where he traveled, the number of sermons he preached, and all of the work he did in London. Ryle says this: "It seems wonderful that any human frame could so long endure the labor he went through." Well, if there's any aspect of Whitfield's life and ministry that mid-Victorian evangelicals seemed to be keeping pace, at least to a relative degree, it was this one. Even their enemies were forced to concede that they labored. Like many evangelical clergymen, Ryle was diligent in his ministrations. For example, Ryle's regular work in Exbury, when he was just ordained to the ministry, included preparing two sermons for Sunday, delivering two expository lectures on Wednesday and Thursday, teaching and superintending the Sunday school, distributing tracts, keeping up regular pastor visitation throughout the week. To this routine, he would later add numerous speaking engagements, sermon publishing, tract writing, and a variety of other literary endeavors. In fact, in the time between Ryle published his first and third biographies of Whitfield, he authored more than 100 works. Thirdly, Ryle attributes Whitfield with being the first to employ the aggressive system. Ryle explains it like this. He was the first to see that Christ's ministers must do the work of fishermen. They must not wait for souls to come to them, but they must go after souls and compel them to come in. He did not sit tamely by his fireside like a cat on a rainy day, mourning over the wickedness of the land. He went forth to beard the devil in high places. He attacked sin and wickedness face to face, and he gave them no peace. He dived into holes and corners after sinners. He hunted out ignorance and vice wherever they could be found. In short, he set on foot a system of action which, up to this time, had been comparatively unknown in this country, but a system which, once commenced, has never ceased to be employed down to the present day. Ryle believes that Whitfield deserves credit for laying down the foundation of many evangelical societies, missions, and works by his own personal example. Again, this is another instance where evangelicals were following in his footsteps. Ian Bradley suggests that their enthusiasm for setting up societies to convert and reform their contemporaries was one of their most important and enduring legacies to the Victorians. Though Ryle did not invent the aggressive system, he certainly employed it. He supported and spoke on behalf of a number of evangelical societies that promoted foreign and home missionaries. These included the Church of England Young Men's Society, the Church Missionary Society, the London Society for the Promotion of Christianity Among the Jews, the Church Pastoral Aid Society, and the Colonial Church and School Society. He also deserves credit, along with Hugh McNeill and John Cale Miller, for founding the special mission services held for the working classes in order to reach the masses of large industrial towns. Ryle also proposed a number of aggressive reforms to reach the lost. These included open-air preaching in densely populated neighborhoods, shorter services for the unchurched, the recognition and licensing of lay agents, the repealing of acts of parliament that fetter up and tie the church's limbs. Though many of these reforms were too radical to be implemented in his day, they demonstrated Ryle's willingness to adopt new aggressive measures to reach the lost and increase the effectiveness of the national church. Finally, Ryle believed that the Church of England's response to Whitfield was a case study in ecclesiastical mismanagement. He points out in Christian Leaders that the agency by which God revived English Christianity in the 18th century was not the government or dissenters or the Church of England as a body. For the most part, it was revived by evangelical clergymen. And he argues that Whitfield was the first and foremost of this body, and that he was a real, genuine son of the Church of England. He was raised in the church. He was educated at Oxford, ordained to its ministry. He honored the articles, the prayer books, and the homilies of the Church of England, and repeatedly references them in his sermons. He was neither a Laudian nor a Latitudinarian. His sympathies were with Cranmer, Latimer, Hooper, and Jewell. In short, Whitfield was as true a churchman as ever breathed. But despite his attachment to the church shut him out in 1739. The leadership of the church didn't understand its times, and to make matters worse, they refused to help those like Whitfield who did, and denounced them as irregular and disorderly when the very existence of English Christianity was at stake. And what was the result of this miserable misgovernment of the Church of England? The church thrust out a talented group of ministers that would have gladly remained in it. Ryle says that this was surely the most insane line of policy that could have been adopted. The church created a new body of separatists, the Methodists. It created breaches that would never be repaired, and their actions only served to further alienate Orthodox dissent and make reunion even less likely. In short, the Church of England's response to Whitfield and his companions was simply disastrous. And the church's miserable misgovernment in the 18th century is a lesson for the 19th. In 1854, many evangelicals like Ryle believed the church was on the verge of making a similar mistake once again. Ryle's referring to the Gorham case. In 1847, the high church bishop of Exeter, Henry Philpotts, refused to institute the evangelical curate George Gorham into the living of Bramford Speke because Gorham rejected baptismal regeneration. Gorham appealed the bishop's decision to the Ecclesiastical Court of Arches and lost, but then appealed to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council and received a favorable verdict. The Gorham judgment of 1850 declared that his baptismal views were not contrary to the doctrine of the Church of England, and he was installed into the vacancy of Bramford Speke, despite Philpott's threat to excommunicate the Archbishop and anyone who dared install him. This controversial judgment ruled that evangelical baptismal views were not contrary to the teaching of the Church, but the position of the church's official position on regeneration and its relationship to baptism remained an open question. Gorham's baptismal views were held by thousands of hardworking evangelical clergymen like Ryle, and it would be impossible to condemn him without, by implication, condemning them. There's nothing new about Gorham's views, Ryle argues. He points out that since the time of the Reformation, there's been a substantial body of faithful men in the Church of England who said to their congregation, "Ye must be born again." If Gorham and his views were to be thrust out, Ryle estimates that at least 3,000 of the church's best ministered would be thrust out and a second great ejection would take place. And Ryle believed that the Gorham case was only the beginning of a larger campaign to narrow the terms of union within the Church of England and drive the evangelicals out. For Ryle, the church's rejection of Whitfield and the disastrous consequences that followed in its wake is an important historical case study. Like Whitfield, the evangelical clergymen are faithful sons of the Church of England. And as was the case in 1739, there is a new attempt to thrust like-minded clergymen out of the church. The rejection of Whitfield had disastrous consequences for the church in the 18th century and beyond, and the rejection of evangelicals in the 19th century would be equally disastrous. Ryle opens Christian leaders of the last century by expressing his lack of sympathy with Englishmen who have no interest in history and biography. He says that such men are poor patriots and even worse philosophers. They can't be called patriots because true patriotism will make an Englishman care for everything that concerns England. And they are even worse philosophers because history is philosophy teaching by examples. For Ryle, understanding the life and ministry of George Whitfield is essential to understanding both the past and the present. It helps the church understand how it's reached its current position, and it serves as a guide for identifying potential standard bearers in the future. In sum, if the church in general and the evangelical body in particular wishes to reap what Whitfield reaped, it must sow as Whitfield sowed. What is wanted in the present is more of George Whitfield's preaching, character, activism, and less ecclesiastical misgovernment.